Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Censorship and Civil Societies, this week on Soundings. Join me now for conversations with Conor Cruise O'Brien, the Irish diplomat and writer, and historian Robert Darnton of Princeton University. I'll talk first with Conor Cruise O'Brien about civil societies and the changing contours of the world's political landscape. After that, Robert Darnton will trace the history of political censorship from 18th century France into contemporary Europe. Over the last 12 months, the world has watched as the old Soviet Union struggles to transform itself into a free market economy. One of the principal impulses underscoring that struggle is the idea of a civil society, that is, the desire for a society characterized by the existence of independent institutions that mediate between individuals and the power of the state. The National Humanities Center recently convened an international group of scholars and writers to examine the idea of a civil society. Among the conferees was Conor Cruise O'Brien, the diplomat and writer who has served as editor-in-chief of the Observer of London and as the Irish delegate to the United Nations. I asked him to explain the idea of a civil society and to place it in the circumstances of recent events in Central and Eastern Europe. Conor Cruise O'Brien.
Well, I think the idea of citizenship in relation to civil societies involves limitation of the authority of the state and extension of the capacity of the citizens to combine in free associations, and for those associations to have a certain autonomy in relation to the state. As I listened to the discussion, I was a bit disturbed about one thing, particularly in relation to what's happening in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union today. Not the day before yesterday, but today.
And bear in mind, we're recording this in the fall of 1991.
Well, that's all right. That's today enough for me. That is that not all associations are necessarily totally benign in all contexts. Mm-hmm. Churches, for example, people who talk about civil society, often bring in the idea of the churches as if the churches were all like what the World Council of Churches is in this country.
But not necessarily so.
But not necessarily so, no. In the old Soviet Empire, to call it by its true name, the churches that are now re-emerging have an authoritarian past, and they may have an authoritarian future. There are some signs that they have. For example, in Poland, the Catholic Church this year has demanded control of education, not only the education of Catholic Poles, but the education of all Polish children, whether Catholic or not. They're to be handed over to Holy Mother Church. Well, that's getting us back to the Middle Ages, and I think those things need to be watched.
One of your observations, Conor Cruise O'Brien, in this conference on the idea of a civil society, help me with the wording now. We are not seeing not only are we seeing the disintegration of communism, in what used to be the Soviet Empire, we're seeing the repeal of the Enlightenment.
Yes.
Now, that's a pretty serious charge to make about this society, and it is not a happy outlook.
Yes. I didn't say the repeal of the Enlightenment over the whole area. I said that in certain areas we are seeing the repeal of the Enlightenment.
Fair enough.
Let me specify areas where this is absolutely clear. This is absolutely clear in relation to Soviet Central Asia, where fundamentalist Islam is back and women are being put in their place. Women are told they must not wear Western clothes any longer. They must not go to work outside the home. They must stay in the home in their own place And do what husband or father tells them to do.
Are they accepting this?
According to the Quran. We don't have much information about that. Mm-hmm. There have been news items, particularly from Tajikistan, which I know a little, and I read with horror of women being molested in public, raped, in fact, it was reported, for the offense of wearing Western clothes. So if this is so, there is terror there. And women can be forced into submission.
Is it possible for us to say that in the United States, in the West, that we are going to provide happy, productive models for the establishment, the creation of civil societies in what used to be the communist empire, the Russian empire?
There's some capacity to do that. I think I would situate the capacity more in Western Europe than in the United States. Hmm. And the attractive power there, which applies to the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, not to the old Soviet Union. The attractive power is the possibility of being admitted to the European community. That means that people in Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia will be disposed to be good boys and girls in order to get in there.
This
and
is that, a question of ground rules.
That's right. That means being decent to minorities and not throwing your weight around and so on. Uh-huh. And even people who don't feel disposed to be decent to minorities will see that that's where their bread is buttered. That's a powerful incentive. So I think that will have its effects. That also applies in a lesser degree to Bulgaria and Romania. But it doesn't apply to the countries of the old Soviet Union, who have virtually no chance of being admitted to the community.
One of the words that is hovering over this conversation that we haven't used explicitly, Conor Cruz O'Brien, is nationalism.
Yes.
Talk to me for a moment about that with respect to the creation and the sustenance of civil societies in what used to be communist Europe.
Well, how nationalism behaves depends on the stresses to which it is subject. You can't say that nationalism in itself is good or bad. You can say that it's necessary to collective life. I don't believe that the United States would hold together, for example, if nationalism, American nationalism, which is subconscious. Americans don't think of it as nationalism.
But there it is.
That's patriotism, if you like. But there it is, and that holds America together. And this is obviously a good thing. But under certain stresses, humiliated nationalism can become the most destructive force in the world. We saw that after the First World War, when humiliated German nationalism produced Nazism. Mm-hmm. That's where that comes from. In the Soviet Union also, nationalisms are being subject to tremendous stresses. Everywhere, different nationalities are in conflict with one another over various territories, ethnic edges. But it's an awful, stew of fermenting nationalities and ethnic groups and religions.
Conor Cruz O'Brien, do you think that conferences such as this that we are holding at the Humanities Center, do you think they do any good? Now, I'm not deliberately trying to be critical. I understand that there is a lot of productive thinking and discussion that goes on. In what way do they contribute to a productive world polity or an exchange of ideas?
Well, I think this is a very good question. These are exchanges of ideas mainly among intellectuals, a few politicians there as well, and some others, but mainly academics.
And you said parenthetically that there is nothing more dangerous than the vanity of intellectuals.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Well, that it is a very destructive force in history.
Yeah.
If we think of the ideologues who were confident in the Marxist-Leninist movement that they were constructing the perfect society. I think we can see.
Yeah.
They were. We've known them. They were exceptionally vain, arrogant, and overbearing. And this was that particular category of intellectuals I was talking about. And one of the disturbing things about the present situation in the former Soviet Empire is that the intelligentsia, who were popular for a brief period in the immediate aftermath of the withdrawal of the Soviet forces. The intelligentsia are now being blamed for the shortages in the shops, because they came into political power, and they didn't know any better than anybody else.
So it's an unfair accusation.
It's unfair, but it's inevitable. Uh-huh. I mean, once they took power, they are to blame. I mean, the king is blamed if the crops are bad or if the fish don't come in, and rulers are the same way.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Connor Cruz O'Brien. Are you optimistic? I mean, in what measure do you mix optimism and pessimism when we talk of the creation of civil societies?
Well, I was talking of civil societies only in the context of the old Soviet empire. And I made the point there are essentially two Soviet empires.
Indeed.
One made up of the old Soviet Union, the other the Baltic states, plus the countries of Central and Eastern Europe. I'm quite optimistic about the latter. I'm deeply pessimistic about the future of the peoples of the Soviet Union. I may be wrong about that. I hope I am, but I don't see much room for optimism.
Connor Cruz O'Brien, you are an Irish statesman, writer, playwright, and we're honored to have you at the National Humanities Center. Thank you for your contribution to Soundings.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Censorship and civil societies, this week on Soundings. Join me now for a conversation with historian Robert Darnton of Princeton University. Robert Darnton recently visited the National Humanities Center to participate in a conference about civil societies. That is, societies in which independent institutions, such as voluntary associations, mediate between the individual and the power of the state. The focus of Robert Darnton's remarks at the conference was political censorship, which he sees as an obstacle to civil societies, but also as a paradox of cultural communication. Although he says we must deplore censorship, Darnton also argues that we should avoid the temptation to oversimplify it, seeking instead to understand how it works in cultural systems. Robert Darnton is an expert on modern French history. I asked him to describe the balance between censorship and free expression at the time of the French Revolution, to trace it into contemporary European culture, and to relate it to the idea of a civil society. Robert Darnton.
Well, take the example of the jelly jars that I tried to give. And the point is that 200 years ago in France, a book was censored, but in becoming censored, it received the royal approbation. Hmm. This was a stamp of approval, a sanction coming from the king himself.
So it wasn't altogether a negative thing.
That's right. It was positive. Uh-huh. What the king was saying, or the king's agents, in this case the censors, is this is a good book. Read this book. You will find it's very well written. You can learn about, and then they give you a list of things, botany, travel, and so on.
Yeah, just like modern-day marmalade. We look at this and we say, hey, it's a good thing that we have this royal stamp.
Well, that's right. I was referring to the jams of jar you see in England, you know, by special appointment to Her Majesty the Queen.
Right.
Well, books existed, so to speak, by special appointment to His Majesty the King. So censorship, in this case, was not simply a matter of purging heresies. It was a matter of saying what was positive about a book.
Do we think of publishing in 18th century France with a necessary sense of unorthodoxy, the radical, the different, that which is undermining the system, so to speak? I mean, when we think of censorship today, we say, well, we're gonna oppress something that the authorities, whatever they may be, don't like.
Well, that's not wrong. But when we think of 18th century French literature, mm-hmm. we think of the great classics, the canon of works by Voltaire, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and Diderot. We don't think of the vast ocean of literature that was out there floating around France and being read by most people.
Was this the underground? Is that a proper term to use?
Well, you can think of an ocean as full of froth on the top and waves and so on.
Yeah.
Let's call that the legal literature. And then all kinds of currents underneath that
yeah.
can be very powerful.
Uh-huh.
Now, my point is that because books were getting the royal stamp of approval, many of them simply could not receive this royal sanction. So
life went on.
Life went on. I mean, there were readers, there were writers, there was a tremendous demand for literature. And the authorities actually weren't fools. They realized that because the rules were so strict to allow books into the legal system, they had to create some flexibility. Mm-hmm. What they did was they invented new categories, which they called tacit permissions, permissions of the police, tolerances, and so on. And they allowed books to exist in these loopholes. But even that wasn't enough for the Enlightenment. Most of the books that we think of as the great works of French literature from this great century of French writing mm-hmm. actually were published outside of France, smuggled into the country, and circulated through an underground.
Let's move forward in time a couple of hundred years, Robert Darnton. Tell me about censorship in, I guess it's fair to say, contemporary, almost contemporary, Eastern Germany.
Well, that's what I found fascinating, because it so happened I was invited to spend a year at the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin, a very good year, 1989-1990.
You were there when the wall came down.
That's right. That's the year the wall fell, the East German regime collapsed. There was something that I would call a revolution in East Germany, and indeed throughout most of Central Europe. So there I was trying to write yet another monograph about 18th century France, dealing with subjects such as the censorship, when another old regime collapsed all around me and something that looked suspiciously like a revolution
right.
burst out. And so, in fact, I dropped my monograph about 18th century France and spent the rest of the year running around interviewing madly, trying to understand how this old regime worked and how it fell apart.
Now, what you were doing here was chronicling an immediate contemporary event, and yet at the same time, in your book about Berlin, you were trying to get into the minds of the, particularly this class of literary figure, the censors. Tell me about them.
Well, the censors turned out to be very interesting people, and fortunately, they were willing to talk, much to my amazement. It's as if everyone wanted to talk suddenly in East Germany because their lips had been sealed for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this great flood of words that came out of everyone. Now, of course, you have to be suspicious. Everyone naturally was trying to defend him or herself. The censors didn't want to appear as apparatchiks and Stalinists. Mm-hmm. Instead, they wanted to indicate they were good liberals who were fighting the system from within. And I had to allow for that once I got to interview them.
The key word here is the system, the complexity of what you observed in the censorship process.
Exactly, because my sense of things is that, as I was saying earlier, literature is systematic. It belongs to a system.
Yeah, this is kind of depressing not to think of this individual writer and then the individual reader and how convenient it is to forget everything that happens.
Well, if I may say so, I think what you're expressing is a usual romantic view of
sure.
literature,
mm-hmm.
Inspiration striking from on high,
right.
sort of flashes going on inside heads and light bulbs lighting up inside the readers. Now, there's something to that, of course, but basically, I think literature is a very complicated process that involves lots of middlemen, and that these middlemen basically have not been studied.
Do we call these censors in modern-day East Germany, Robert Darnton, do we call them villains? Do we impute really dark motives to them? I mean, they were, the sense I got listening to your remarks is that, hey, come on, give these people a break. You know, they were doing basically what they thought was the right thing to do.
Well, I'm not especially eager to give them a break. I mean, they were certainly suppressing a lot of independent thought. So I'm not at all making an apology for them. But I think we need to understand them. And I think the first rule in attempting to understand things, a rule we've learned from anthropologists and sociologists, is listen to the natives. Try to see things from the native point of view.
Uh-huh.
So what I attempted to do, actually spent a lot of time with the censors and went to their office, and they took me through the stages of the whole process, gave me documents, etc. What I tried to do was to actually see how the system functioned from their point of view.
All right, so without apologizing for them, you were explaining the complexity of what they went through.
Yes, precisely. Now, when I asked them point blank, all right, what is censorship?
Right.
The answer of one of them, Herr Wesener is his name, was, in a word, planning.
Planning.
Now, that rocked me back on my heels, because I I mean, it just hadn't occurred to me that that's the kind of answer they would come up with. And that, I think, is significant in this sort of seat-of-the-pants sociology.
Here we have a kind of a flow chart moving all the way from Honecker on down to, the apparatchiks.
That's right, and the sensors on the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. The flow chart is something I actually drafted myself from the information they gave me. When they said planning, though, what they meant was, look, literature has to be socially engineered, like everything else in a socialist society. Literature doesn't just happen. You make it happen. And the role of the censor, not that they liked the word, but the role of the censor, putting it frankly, was to make literature happen.
And on the other side of the coin, you had people who were engineering, planning what? The subversive, the radical, the contradictory. They were doing it. Tell me briefly about some of these means and methods, the way the words appear on the page. And what went through my mind was the old George Herbert poems, you know, The Altar, where you've got these large letters that spell out a message.
Well, what happened, of course, is that just as in France in the 18th century, there was not only a system, but a counter system,
yeah,
a kind of underground. There also was West Germany. In the case of East Germany, just as in France, there were publishing houses outside, mm-hmm, of France publishing in French and smuggling the books inside.
Not to mention radio and television.
Yes, more radio and TV in the case of 20th century Germany than the case of 18th century,
sure,
France.
Sure.
But you're quite right to mention these other media that were very, very important. In any case, what sometimes happened is that a book by a dissident writer, such as Christoph Wolff, would be smuggled out of East Germany, published in West Germany in its entirety. Then the East Germans, after there had been a certain amount of fuss made over this book in the West, would publish their version of it and congratulate themselves on their liberalism. But of course, they cut out all the key parts.
Right.
And what I found in talking with East German readers, because I tried to understand how readers read as well as how censors censored, what I found in talking with the readers is that they had got their hands on the West German copies and then had extracted the censored passages, typed them out, put them on slips of paper, and slipped the slips of paper in between the pages of the East German editions.
This is enough to get you arrested. Have I got this right?
Oh, it could get you arrested. Things eased up by the mid-1970s. Huh. Before that, this sort of thing was extremely dangerous. But after that, it became something of a game. Now, imagine the experience of reading a book in which you have got slips of paper larded between the pages that are alerting you to the very passages that the regime wanted to keep out.
Uh-huh.
I think that it stimulated a kind of aggressive reading, a reading in which people are looking for the illicit messages, literally reading between the lines, because the messages that were absent, that were in the blank spaces between the lines, those messages are actually typed out for you.
Let's reflect for a moment, Robert Darnton, on the implications of what this term, the civil society, with respect to what's going on in contemporary Europe, Eastern Europe. Things aren't going to change overnight. We have to have a transition period. What is happening with the process, the system of literature? How does that, might that contribute to our ideas of civil society?
Well, we don't know exactly what's happening to it, or I should say what will happen to it, but I think there is we can have a clear picture of confusion, so to speak. There has been a breakdown of the old system in which literature was planned and everything fit into everything else. It was totally controlled and then produced this counter system of the underground. That has broken down, and it means that there is tremendous disarray in East Germany, not to mention the other countries. The book selling, book publishing, the Authors League, reading, everything has been transformed, and indeed there has been a kind of tidal wave of West German literature that has overwhelmed the book industries in West Germany.
And this is a good thing. Is this where you're taking me?
Well, it's a good thing in that the old system was totally controlled by the state. It had crevices and fissures through which a certain amount of free expression seeped. But I think it is a good thing that it's destroyed, of course. However, there have been losses. It was possible to live as a writer specializing in academic subjects, for example, such as opera. I have a friend who's a great authority in opera, and he wrote a whole series of fascinating books on opera.
And now he's out on the free market.
Exactly, which means he's out on the street.
Uh-huh.
There are a great many unemployed intellectuals and scholars. I mean, the Academy of Sciences in East Germany had 240,000 members.
My goodness.
That's 250,000 people in a country of 16 million. But you cannot, I think, suddenly transform a socialist command economy into a free market one. And how this is going to happen, what the future is in places like the Soviet Union, to me, is very, very cloudy. Maybe some of the other experts that are here can prophesy better than I can.
Mm-hmm.
But what I see now is disarray, misery, discontent, and not a nostalgia for the old world, but despair about the new one.
Robert Darton, I want to thank you for your participation on Soundings. You're here at the Humanities Center for a conference on the idea of a civil society. You are a professor of European history at Princeton University, and among your books, The Great Cat Massacre and Berlin Journal. I'm grateful for your time here on the radio.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've just heard conversations about political ideology, censorship, and the idea of a civil society. The speakers were Robert Darton of Princeton University and Conor Cruise O'Brien, the Irish diplomat and writer. If you'd like a cassette copy of their conversations, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 602. That's program number 602, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Mississippi Voices. I'll talk with two writers, Elizabeth Spencer and Larry Brown. Elizabeth Spencer will talk about her latest book, a novel entitled The Night Travelers. Larry Brown will discuss his latest novel, a book entitled Joe. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Censorship and Civil Societies, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Robert Darton of Princeton University discusses censorship and civility in modern European history. Conor Cruise O'Brien, the Irish diplomat and writer, discusses changing political landscapes and civil societies, that is, independent institutions capable of mediating between individuals and the state. Censorship and Civil Societies. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.